This morning's reading's in three parts, starting in 1 Samuel 17, that's page 282 in the Old Testament section of the Good News Bible. So 1 Samuel 17, beginning at verse 20. David got up early the next morning, left someone else in charge of the sheep, took the food and went as Jesse had told him to. He arrived at the camp just as the Israelites were going out to their battle line, shouting the war cry. The Philistine and the Israelite armies took up positions for battle, facing each other. David left the food with the officer in charge of the supplies, ran to the battle line, went to his brothers and asked how they were getting on. As he was talking to them, Goliath came forward and challenged the Israelites as he had done before, and David heard him. When the Israelites saw Goliath, they ran away in terror. "Look at him," they said to each other. "Listen to his challenge. King Saul has promised to give a big reward to the man who kills him. The king will also give him his daughter to marry and will not require his father's family to pay taxes." David asked the men who were near him, "What will the man get who kills this Philistine and frees Israel from this disgrace? After all, who is this heathen Philistine to defy the army of the living God?" They told him what would be done for the man who killed Goliath. Eliab, David's eldest brother, heard David talking to the men. He was angry with David and said, "What are you doing here? Who's taking care of those sheep of yours out there in the wilderness? You cheeky brat, you. You just came to watch the fighting." "Now what have I done?" David asked. "Can't I even ask a question?" He turned to another man and asked him the same question, and every time he asked, he got the same answer. Some men heard what David had said, and they told Saul, who sent for him. David said to Saul, "Your Majesty, no one should be afraid of this Philistine. I will go and fight him." "No," answered Saul, "how could you fight him? You're just a boy, and he's been a soldier all his life." Now on to verse 41 to 51. The Philistine started walking towards David with his shield bearer walking in front of him. He kept coming closer, and when he got a good look at David, he was filled with scorn for him because he was just a nice, good-looking boy. He said to David, "What's that stick for? Do you think I'm a dog?" And he called down curses from his God on David. "Come on," he challenged David, "and I will give your body to the birds and animals to eat." David answered, "You are coming against me with sword, spear, and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the Israelite armies, which you have defied. This very day the Lord will put you in my power, and I will defeat you and cut off your head, and I will give the bodies of the Philistine soldiers to the birds and animals to eat. Then the whole world will know that Israel has a God, and everyone here will see that the Lord does not need swords or spears to save his people. He is victorious in battle, and he will put all of you in our power." Goliath started walking towards David again, and David ran quickly towards the Philistine battle line to fight him. He put his hand into his bag and took out a stone, which he slung at Goliath. It hit him on the forehead and broke his skull, and Goliath fell face downwards on the ground. And so, without a sword, David defeated and killed Goliath with a sling and a stone. He ran to him, stood over him, took Goliath's sword out of its sheath, and cut off his head and killed him. And finally, chapter 18, verse 7 and 8. In their celebration, the women sang, "Saul has killed thousands, but David has killed tens of thousands." Saul did not like this, and he became very angry. He said, "For David, they claim tens of thousands, but only thousands for me. They will be making him king next."
Thank you very much. A very traditional and famous story of David and Goliath, and often interpreted on the basis of facing overcoming obstacles, the courage that's needed to face adversity, the ability to look for opportunities even in situations which appear to be very hopeless. We could look at the story on the basis of other giants that we see in the world, perhaps the giants of injustice. And believe me, there are a lot of giants roaming the streets of our world today. At every turn, we see injustice and bullying tactics. And I suppose the greatest giant of these has been slain in the last few days, as shown on the front cover of Time magazine, of Donald Trump and the migrants. But that giant, I don't think, is completely dead yet. Not until the 2,300 odd children are reunited with their families. Standing up to these giants can be a very risky business. Not least of which, they will encourage criticism of us from others. I don't know when you were growing up, how many of you liked the Peanuts film character strip? Peanuts? A little bit, yes. Two, three, four. With Snoopy and Woodstock and Charlie Brown and Lucy and Linus. Now, there was once a strip where Linus was seated with a very troubled loom on his face. As always, he was seated with his very trusted security blanket over his shoulder and his thumb in his mouth. And Lucy, turning to Lucy, he asked, "Why is it you always are so anxious to criticize me?" And Lucy responds, "Well, I just have a knack for seeing other people's faults." "What about your own faults?" Lunas asks. And without hesitation, Lucy replies, "I have a knack of overlooking them." Now I wonder, are you a Lucy in someone's life? How many Lucys are there in this church? There are certainly plenty of Lucys out in the global church and in the wider community. And we hear them and face them on a regular basis. You see, whenever people work for something they believe in or face up to something which they feel is oppressive, they will always be putting themselves in the firing line of various forms of criticism. And so this morning I would like us to look at this very famous story of David and Goliath to identify how David was viewed by the other characters from within the story. And to consider the different forms and types of criticisms which he faced, which could have been severely detrimental to the people of Israel if David had not stood up to face Goliath. So I have four C's for us to consider. The critical view, the you can't view, the contemptuous view, and the courageous view. Our story starts on the cusp of war between the Israelites and the Philistines. The Philistine army was a very powerful and fearful group of soldiers who had gathered on the shores and the borders of Judah at Socah. The Israelite people looked to Saul, their appointed king, to show his strength, to show his power, and to defeat this enemy which had come before them. But when Saul and the other soldiers saw the vastness of the giants who had come before them, they quaked in their armor, rattled like coins in our pockets. They were petrified, which made the jeers from Goliath the Philistine even more terrifying. Nobody was prepared to put themselves forward to fight this giant man. Now Saul should have put himself forward as the leader of the nation, but he abdicated his responsibility to... Well, actually, there was nobody who was prepared to take up the fight. And night after night, day after day, 40 days we're told in total, the Israelite soldiers were taunted to send someone to fight Goliath. And one by one, one-on-one, with the consequences that whoever lost the fight, the whole nation would lose and could be plundered. And it's at this point in our story that David steps in. He was a little runt of a lad, the youngest of a number of sons from Jesse, and was perhaps not particularly liked by or regarded by his elder brothers. We first hear of David as a shepherd boy out in the fields looking after his father's sheep. Here also in the story, we have David running between Saul and the sheep he was looking after and grazing around Bethlehem. And David's task was to take sustenance to his three eldest brothers and to the other commanders of the units, but was also to bring back word to his father, who would have obviously been concerned about his three eldest sons in battle with Saul. But this morning, David's arrival was to be different. This time, he heard for himself the challenge being given to the Philistines. And he was appalled that Saul, nor any of the other soldiers, was rising up to volunteer to fight this man. And I'm sure he would have said as much to his brothers. Which is where we find our first view of David, the critical view. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came only to watch the battle." Now, Eliab was critical, not and did not welcome David's presence among the soldiers. Surely, he mused, David's real reason was to not to come and bring food, but to watch the spectacle of the battle. Perhaps Eliab was annoyed because of their reluctance to go into battle would clearly be revealed to the soldiers and their backbone, lack of backbone, meaning that they were, in effect, scaredy cats. They would not be shown in a positive light, either to their father, who would obviously take word back to their dad via David, this little sprat of a brother. But never will they be able to live it down as they faced him either. You know, whenever we try to do something new for the church or for the Lord, there will always be people who will try to criticize us, either for our motives or because of who we are, the values that we hold or how we live our lives. And that goes for being outside the church as well as within it. Surely there must be some ulterior motive why you're doing this or that. We're surely under some sort of personal gain or kudos, to be looked upon favorably, to be noticed, that we might gain affection or that job opportunity that we're striving for. The last couple of years, I have got involved in the Bible Society's Act of Kindness campaign during the weeks leading up to Christmas. Have you seen this campaign? A couple of you have. The purpose of this campaign is that on every day of Advent, you try to perform at least one act of kindness for the benefit of somebody else. Now, whether that's helping a stranger pack their shopping or loading it into their car, or cooking a meal for somebody in need, or simply just talking to somebody that you don't often speak to. Now, I don't know what sort of responses you get when you do something like that, but I find that often people view my act of generosity with suspicion. What's my ulterior motive? Even to the extent of refusing gifts of grace and kindness. As a church, only 2 weeks ago, we held here the community lunch, which I think had the same response from some within our community. A free barbecue? Why would you do that? What do you really want from me? And so consequently, we are looked upon with suspicion because of our generosity. It's not often expected within Western culture. Now, I'm not saying for one moment that sometimes others, or even ourselves, if we're honest, we do things with mixed or hidden motives. We all do, and so do other people. But perhaps we shouldn't be so judgmental and jump to that first and most obvious conclusion that there will always be a hidden agenda behind some act of kindness being done or a role being fulfilled. So there's our first C, the critical view. But if we're acting with pure and unselfish motives, let us not be put off by that critical view that we might receive from others. Because to do so will mean that we fall at the first hurdle and nothing will get done for the Lord, either in our lives or here in church itself. The second is that you can't view. Notice Saul's reaction to David's suggestion that if no one was prepared to go out and fight this uncircumcised Philistine who defies the armies of the living gods, then he himself, David, would go out and fight. And Saul replied, "You are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth." The same criticism has been levied at David earlier in his life when Samuel had come to find and anoint the first king over the region. In chapter 8, if you want to look it up, of 1 Samuel. As we heard from our Bible study 2 weeks ago, Samuel was instructed to go to Bethlehem and anoint one of the 7 sons of Jesse. And each one of the sons was paraded out in front of Samuel, but each one of them was not the chosen one by God. And it was with gasps of shock and horror that David was finally chosen. "He's too young!" everyone shouted, especially his envious brothers. Jesus himself faced this same, "You can't," criticism at the beginning of ministry. "Him?" exclaimed Andrew. "But he comes from Nazareth. What good has ever come out from Nazareth?" "You can't do that. It's the Sabbath. It's the day of the Lord." And this kind of criticism is often unleashed when people don't understand either what is involved or what is required, or perhaps based on a particular historical event. "There's no point doing this or that activity. We tried that in 1803, and it didn't work then, so it won't work now." How many times have we heard in our church meetings as to why we as an individual or as a church should not do something or some sort of activity? "We're too young. We're too inexperienced. We have rules and procedures to follow and we haven't followed them. It's too dangerous, perhaps." But if God is directing us in a particular direction, then who are we to say we can't proceed? Mary and I just started a new house group in North Calm, and the book we've decided to work on and explore together is this one, "If You Want to Walk on Water, You Have to Get Out of the Boat." If Peter had listened either to his own mind or to the other men in the disciples, the other disciples in the boats, telling them that, well, walking on water? That's preposterous. You can't do that. Then he would never have got out of the boat in the first place. But he did. And he got out of the boat and started walking on water towards Jesus. And for those of you who remember the story, the moment that Peter started looking at the storm and away from Jesus, that was when he started to doubt himself. You can't do this, Peter. It's insane. And so the moment he started to listen to the "you can't" view, that was when he started to sink into the water. Pure negativism is like a fire blanket put over the flames. It will stifle activity and growth. So like David, we should have the courage and faith in our convictions, in the one we call our God, to see things through to completion. If things are of God, then nothing can thwart the purposes of God, even if it defies human sense and realism. And so our third criticism of David's, which I'm going to call the contemptuous view. Am I a dog, says Goliath, that you come with me with sticks? Come here and I will give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. I suppose we face this sort of criticism most from those outside of the church rather than inside. Not only are people critical of our actions, or they try to stop us because they say that we can't do this or that, but they criticize us for who we are. Now, whether that's because we are simply followers of Jesus, or they see us as people to whom they can make fun of and belittle because of our values, people sometimes see us as weak, as fair game to have a pop-up. Treating someone with contempt is like treating them with disrespect and disdain, with mockery, name-calling, aggressive humour and sarcasm. These are all examples of a contemptuous behaviour. And the overall aim is to make that person feel despised, worthless. And how many times have we come across this type of criticism in our own lives or in the life of the church? And the danger for the Christian of listening and believing such comments is not to damage our belief and our trust in God, but actually damage to our Christian disposition or state of mind. But let us never forget that we serve not a God of our own making, or to suit and meet our own desires and delights, but if we serve and we follow the Almighty God, maker of the universes and all that is within them, a God who delights in his creation yet has a heart for each one of us as individuals. And it is in his service that we live and we move and have our being. If we are on the receiving end of contemptuous criticism, it's not us who is being criticized, but God himself. So when we are tempted to give in to resentment and to strike back, remember those words from Peter's first letter. If you suffer from doing good and endure it patiently, God is pleased with you. For God calls you to do good, even if it means suffering. just as Christ suffered for you. He is your example, and you must follow in his steps. He never sins, nor ever deceived anyone. Do not, therefore, retaliate when he was insulted. He did not retaliate when he was insulted, nor threaten revenge when he was when he suffered. He left his case in the hands of God, who always judges fairly. And so we finally come to our fourth and probably most damaging criticism of all, the courageous view. Following David's resounding defeat of Goliath, David was a hero, and the people of Israel treated him and hailed him as such. When the men returned home from David, after David had killed the Philistines, and the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. And as they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his tens thousands, and David his..." Sorry, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." We can all easily picture the scene, can't we? With David being carried high on somebody's shoulder as they came in towards Jerusalem. The people of Jerusalem coming out of their houses, waving whatever they found available as the soldiers, as the procession went by. But they were not really rejoicing because of King Saul's victory, but of David's. He was the hero of the day, which was later to see him succeed King Saul. Now, it would have all been too easy for this accolade to go to David's head. All too easy for the praise and glory to ours too. C.J. Rhodes once said, "When people praise you, don't let it get to your heads. When they criticize you, don't let it get to your hearts." Now, there's nothing wrong with taking in praise, and there's nothing wrong with feeling good about ourselves. We all want to feel good and happy. It's only natural. The problem comes when we're doing good deeds with a sense of smugness and a feeling of, "Look at me. I'm so good in doing this." Because that's an indication that we're not really giving, we're receiving, we're taking. Then if the receiver of our works is not grateful, our happiness can turn quickly to resentment. The old adage, pride comes before a fall. So instead of letting praise go to our heads, we should receive it with gratitude as a positive sign that we're perhaps on the right road. But ultimately, we need to discern whether what we are doing is being done for the Lord and for his glory, or whether it is for us that we're trying to please. So in summary, as we make our decisions of actions within this church in the coming weeks and months and years, whether that is to do with the future location and buildings or the various forms of mission we undertake within this community of Calm, as we serve the Lord in the many and differing ways in which he called us, both inside and outside of the church, as we fight the giants of injustice and discrimination that we see all around us, people are going to say a lot of things about us. Some good, and some definitely bad. But let's face it, we all like to criticize others, so we can't really expect others won't be critical of us too. But if God has indeed called us into action, however great or however small, let us not be put off by the criticisms and the snipes
that we receive from others. Being critical either of our actions or our motives, or trying to stop us from our work because we're somehow not allowed to do so, because it doesn't conform to other people's expectations, when we ourselves are in receipt of contempt for who we are as Christians. And if on the occasions we are praised, and it does happen sometimes, but sadly not often enough, let us not allow it to puff us up temporarily. Because Jesus tells us that there will be no further reward in heaven for us, because the reward has already been given. Instead, let us offer up such praise and acclamation to God. For it is He who is the one who guides us, who empowers us and strengthens us, for us to work in His kingdom as He chooses. Let us pray. David wasn't overwhelmed by the giant Goliath and slew him with a single stone. Jesus wasn't overwhelmed by a crowd of thousands of hungry people, but fed them with a few loaves and fish. Please, Lord, help us not to be overwhelmed by the worries and fears of our lives, but help us to trust that You walk with us, care for us, and will help us moment by moment and day by day. Amen.